So the great tragedy of the present national security policy is that it offers no way out. It offers nothing to look down the road for and to find a time or a situation in which the tensions and dangers of the present era will be less. Because a second characteristic of this era, different from the first post-war generation, is that we are in a new political game. The world that existed between 1945 and roughly 1965 was different in two respects. It was a two-man chess game. The United States and the Soviet Union held together such a monopoly of world power that power had not begun to diffuse around the world as it has in a very dramatic way in the last 10 to 15 years. Much of it as a direct consequence of policies of the United States and the Soviet Union themselves. One of the things we have done is to ship around the world, we and the Soviets, large quantities of military hardware to some very poor countries, which are underdeveloped in everything but the ability to kill lots of people. And with that capacity, they then become actors in the world stage. Neither the United States nor the Soviet Union can control what goes on in Iran, or Saudi Arabia, nor large parts of Africa. And increasingly, I think it's going to be true of the nations in each other's backyard, in Eastern Europe and in Latin America, that this monolithic hold of the two powers over the world economy is breaking up. That in many respects, I think, is a positive development. But it makes the world a much more dangerous place if you don't understand that that's what's happening. If you pretend that we are back in the world of John Foster Dulles and Dean Acheson and resurrect policies that may have worked at that earlier time to maintain American power, we will find that we are courting precisely the situation in which a nuclear war can most likely happen. That is by a miscalculation. A war is not likely to happen, in my view, by the scenario of the defense intellectuals, the picture of Brezhnev waiting by the computer. That's not what's likely to happen. It's much more likely to happen coming out of a confrontation in a place like Saudi Arabia, or perhaps in Southern Africa, or perhaps in the Caribbean, in which, contrary to the expectation of one side or the other, the adversary does not back down in the crunch. Nuclear politics is very much like the old game of chicken that teenagers used to play with cars. Who's going to swerve off first? And that game was not very dangerous if you knew the answer in advance. And in the days when the Soviet Union was not, in fact, even in the arms race, which was the situation up until the mid-60s, it really was a one-man race. We were racing ourselves, is what Jerome Wiesner put it, the president of MIT. And in that situation, one could assume the outcome. And even though President Kennedy, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, said the chances were somewhere between 1 in 3 and even, that there would have been a nuclear war in which hundreds of millions of people would have been killed. That's what he said after the event. Today, the uncertainties are even greater. That is, the likelihood of a nuclear war is greater than it was then. And one cannot assume that it will always be the Soviet Union that backs down. So we are living in a world that is different from the world that we have been through. But our strategies and our tactics and our way of thinking about it don't mirror those changes. And so the war prevention strategy that we have developed has some real problems in it. For one thing, it is enormously complicated. It depends really on everything going right. It depends on submarine commanders submerged for months each with his finger on a button that can destroy 400 cities in a few minutes, being both rational, assuming that the silence on the communication system it means that there has not been a nuclear war, rather than that there has been and Washington has been knocked out and we don't know what to do. It depends on complete rationality and coolness of leaders in a crisis, because this kind of arms race situation, we have no negotiations, we begin to raise the temperature and raise the rhetoric, is going to involve more and more diplomatic crises. It requires that people without sleep, without any kind of relief, insulated from the world, sitting a few people, four or five people, sitting in a basement room in the White House, as was the case in the Cuban Missile Crisis, cut off really from all kinds of associations, are always going to make the right decisions, that they're not going to make a false step. I suggest you read the memoirs of the people who participated in that week in 1962. I remember it. I was in the government, and I will never forget it. Because you do not have, at that moment, the kind of bravado that you see now reflected in presidential speeches and policy statements about nuclear war isn't so bad. We can win a nuclear war. Nuclear wars can be limited. If only we show them that we are more prepared than they to fight a nuclear war, we won't have one. You did not have that kind of talk in Washington after a few American leaders had gone through that unprecedented moment, that unprecedented experience of actually having to make those decisions. So, and now you see, with the new counterforce weapons, we are moving to a time when the reaction time for making the decision whether to go to war or to stay at peace is becoming dangerously compressed. It's about 20 minutes now, it's going to be less. And because the complexity of the system, the decisions about whether to interpret ambiguous events, like something shows up on the radar screen, in the past it's been flocks of geese, it's been transmission failures in the system, those decisions are now going to be made increasingly by computers. And we have to assume in this war prevention system that we have developed that the computers will behave significantly better than any computer you've ever heard of. Certainly any better than the ones that we daily have experience with in department store, billing offices, the telephone company, and wherever. We are making a tremendous bet that technology is going to keep the peace. And that is a bet, I think, which the evidence of our recent history, and I would say all history, gives very little cause to have faith. So I think we're talking about a war prevention system that is in deep trouble. It is also a war prevention system that has enormous costs, even if the war is avoided. We talk about the economic costs. It has been fashionable in recent years for critics of military spending, liberals mostly, to say we are sacrificing the needs of the society to the military. We are spending money on guns that should be spent on butter. But the fact is that all during this period through which we have come, that wasn't quite true. The fact was that the competition for the dollar was not between guns and butter. It was between guns and the possibilities of more butter. We weren't really cutting, but we are now at the point where we are cutting very substantially. And we are cutting not only the welfare programs, but we are cutting the education programs, and we are cutting the health programs, and we are cutting into the research programs to improve the productivity of the country. We are, in effect, cutting away at the real strength of the country. A country in this moment in history that says we are going to sacrifice for the military, and what we are going to sacrifice is energy and education, has a view of the national security priorities that are so distorted that it is almost impossible to believe that they are living in the world of today. For a country that is unable to invest in its future cannot be a strong country. It's a panicked country. And particularly if the investments which it is making in the name of national security are not making it stronger, they're making it weaker and less secure because they are increasing the possibilities of a nuclear war. This administration has based its whole economic strategy on the idea that we must cut government spending and we must reduce taxes. And the whole theory for reinvigorating the economy, and it's really a psychological theory. It's a theory that says our people in industry and people who are making the investment decisions and people who are working are going to produce more, perform better if we do this. And a critical part of this whole idea is cutting government spending. But somehow we have accepted the idea that Pentagon spending is not government spending. And so we spend more for government and increase deficits, which in fact undermine the whole theory of the economic program. And now we are beginning to see that those who are making those investment decisions understand that probably the most significant contributors to the peace movement in the United States today, beyond the churches and beyond some of the other groups, is Wall Street, where in fact people are beginning to see that there is a fundamental contradiction between military budgets of this sort and an economic plan for restoring some kind of health and stability to the society. It doesn't work. And that's a cost which is going to be felt in many different ways. Not only is it going to undermine the confidence in the economic program, but the costs of systematic disinvestment in the society also are going to be increasingly felt. I live in Washington, D.C., and parts of Washington, D.C., if you go down the street and look at them, appear as if the war has already happened. What you see is not only the total desolation, block after block, and you can see the same thing in the South Bronx, and you can see it in the heart of many, many of our cities in this country. But what you also see is a breakdown of order and a very advanced state of social dissolution. There are cities in Washington, D.C. that you cannot walk on because they are war zones, literally. They are controlled by the drug traffic, and you go there at your peril. A friend of mine was shot in the head 3 weeks ago because he hadn't gotten the word that this particular street had become part of the war zone. We have a situation today where the underground economy, where more and more of the economic transactions, because of the way we are managing the legitimate economy, are going outside, all the way from efforts to avoid taxes by corporations, to avoid restrictions on borrowing by going outside, to, of course, the enormous crime and drug economy. And that the failure to see these problems as the primary national security threats against which we do have some real ammunition, some real programs and ideas, is, I think, a tremendous failure in our whole approach to national security. Again, I think we have to look at what it means to this country, which spends so much more on the military than the other industrial countries, and so much less on industrial research, innovation, for the kinds of things that people would want to make at prices that they can afford around the world. Is it any wonder that this country is seriously losing ground, and people are losing jobs, and communities are dying, because we are unable to confront the problem of international competition and the reorganization of the international economy that has taken place before our very eyes, but which we, because of our outmoded notions of national security, are unable seriously to respond to. I think we have to look at the political costs. The political costs in terms of American power and influence in the world. After all, the whole purpose of this military buildup, as it has been presented, is to have influence in the world. We are clearer that we want influence than what we want that influence for. But that we want influence is the basic notion behind our national security policy. And yet, I think we are losing influence in very dramatic ways, very rapidly. Certainly, what is going on in Europe, our effort to present to them, the people of Europe, the idea that they will be safer if we put on their territory a bunch of missiles which are highly vulnerable to Soviet attack, which are highly provocative, because the Soviets will have more incentive to go to their own launch on warning strategy and to think more about preemptive strategies, preemptive strikes, a situation where a military planner becomes nervous is not one which enhances our security. We ought to be constantly worrying about the nervousness of the Soviet military planners. It's my interest and your interest that the Soviet military planners go to bed every night reasonably happy. And when they aren't, we worry, and we should worry. And the Europeans are worried because we are presenting a situation to them in which we seem to be saying that negotiation is either a disagreeable and perfunctory duty to be performed under duress, or at something that we will get to after we spend the $1.5 trillion, or that we will do what we often do, enter into a prolonged negotiation which becomes, in effect, an adjunct of the real estate industry in the particular city where they're meeting. We've been meeting the Russians in Vienna for many years on something called the MBFR, force reductions in Europe. Neither side had any intention of coming to an agreement when they came into those negotiations. They were show negotiations for various political purposes. And the only beneficiaries of it have been the people who own real estate in Vienna. But I think the problem now is that it's both a problem for the United States government and I think an opportunity for the world, that there is a serious peace movement in Europe which has grown and which is saying to the United States, we do not see how a war can be avoided if things go on as they are. The danger of war is increasing. Your war prevention strategy shows no sign of working. You show no interest in working out another strategy. Therefore, we do not see you as a protector, but we see you increasingly as a menace to our security. And contrary to what some newspapers are writing, my experience, having been in Germany several times in the last year, is that this is not a left movement or a radical fringe, but extends far across the political spectrum, for including anyone who thinks a minute about their existential condition 4 minutes away from the Russian bomb. And in that situation, you tend to, that 4 minutes, perhaps the difference between 20 minutes and 4 minutes has a way of concentrating the mind. But there is no question that anti-Americanism is rising in Europe, and it is, in my view, unnecessary and regrettable anti-Americanism. It is coming about because of a growing isolation of this country from the sentiments and concerns of a majority of people around the world, and particularly now in Europe. Certainly what we did on the neutron bomb was calculated. and it seems to be only intended as a deliberate statement that we don't care what you think. Well, that message gets across, and it has very dangerous consequences for the United States, and I think for the peace of the world. One thing we don't talk about much is the moral cost of this particular system of war prevention. Not so long ago, about 2 weeks ago, the Gallup organization had a poll with some extraordinary results. It showed that 47% of you and the rest of us in the United States believe that a nuclear war is either likely or very likely within 10 years. And that 9 out of 10 believe that they personally have either a very bad chance or at best a 50-50 chance of surviving such a war. Now, what does that say about the state of the nation? It says that half the people, and with young people it turns out to be higher, it's that half the nation, roughly, is mired in a politics of despair, a pessimism which cannot but be crippling to the future, because the one thing that energizes people and allows them to be productive is a sense of the future. A nation without a sense of the future can't have a future. And that is a consequence, I think, of a very deep feeling that people have, which I think is a correct feeling, that for all the mumbo-jumbo and the technical talk about these weapons and strikes and counter-strikes and windows of vulnerability, they don't believe at some basic level that it can work. And this instinctive reaction means that one of the most basic purposes of a national security policy, namely to allow people to feel secure, has totally failed. What does it mean to have a national security policy which does not provide a sense of security? And then I think we need to look in a way that we have not as a nation at the costs in our feelings, in our psychology, of the peculiar hostage system which we have developed. And that is a system which says that, well, it's a terrible thing to take 53 hostages, but we are prepared as a matter of national policy to make 100 million people. That was the figure that the National Security Council used as the likely number of casualties in an attack on the Soviet Union. 100 million people hostages for the behavior of their leaders, 3, 4, 5 leaders, over whom they have absolutely no control, and neither do we. In the moment of crisis, no one in this room has a control over what the nation is going to do. If we have control over the future, it's now. It's before the crisis happens. And I think that we need now to look at what we have been saying to the world and to ourselves about nuclear weapons. In 1980, under the last administration, just so you don't think I'm partisan, we had an assistant secretary of state state on national television, in answer to the question, in a nuclear war, are we committed not to make the first strike? The answer was, no, sir, which is a restatement of a policy that we have had again and again, that we insist upon the right to use nuclear weapons first. But he then added, the Soviets know that this terrible weapon has been dropped on human beings twice in history, and it was an American president who dropped it both times. Therefore, they have to take this consideration into their calculus. That, it seems to me, is elevating nuclear terrorism to the status of national policy. And the costs of that, I think, are going to be very, very heavy. I would like to finish by saying what do we do about this? What is it possible to do about it? Part of the great problem in this country is that there is a great sense of apathy, which comes, I think, from a feeling that there isn't anything that can be done about it. The feeling is that somehow these are too big issues, too complicated, too based on technical issues to be dealt with by ordinary people. Well, the first thing I'd like to say is that these issues are not technical, and they are not secret. All the information that is necessary to make these decisions about which way to go on a national security policy are available to the public. The secrets concern details. The essentials are public. It is not true that facts are not available. What is at issue are judgments, instincts about the implications of those facts. And on that, people differ very much. But I would say first that citizens, certainly people in universities, certainly people who care about not having a nuclear war in the next 10 years, need to know those facts. It is not a hopeless proposition by any means, and I'm very happy that there is a serious effort on this campus to spread that information and to have the facts put before people. That's the first step. But then after the facts, it's necessary to do something. And it is